it's good architecture and it's great, you know, I mean, it should be sustainable, you know. But if it's not good, I mean, I don't think you should want and you should win an award. I couldn't practice if I wasn't teaching the way I do. I couldn't teach if I wasn't practicing the way I do.
Welcome to PA Talks, a podcast where we dive deep into the ever-evolving world of architecture, design, and technology. I'm Hamit Hasanzadeh, your guide in this captivating journey. Today, we're excited to have Marcelo Espino, a force in global architecture and co-principal of Los Angeles-based Patterns Architecture Studio. As an esteemed educator, Marcelo has taught in SciArch and lectured worldwide, sharing his vision that merged design, innovation, and education. Marcelo's journey began in Rosario, Argentina, and led him to Columbia University for his Master's of Architecture. His work, which is celebrated through awards like Architectural Leaks, Emerging Voices, and various AIA's accolades, challenges conventional boundaries. He has co-authored pivotal texts like Embedded, Material Beyond Materials, and Mute Icons, contributing significantly to architectural discourse. Join us as we discuss Marcelo's transformative ideas and methodologies, shedding light on his impact of the future of architecture. Make sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel and hit the bell notification so you receive the future updates. I hope you enjoy the podcast. Thank you so much, Marcelo, for stopping by in our office, and it's good to see you in Istanbul.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here and to be in this amazing city.
Thank you so much. So how do you find Istanbul? Do you like it?
I love Istanbul. I think it's one of my best cities, you know, if I had
second time here?
Second time here, yes.
Nice. So you just handed me this book, which is Mute Icons. I'm going to definitely read it. I had some overviews before about the book. So maybe you can just tell us, what is the book about? What do you mean by mute icons? And to our audience, so they can understand the methodologies that you want to talk about in architecture and share your ideas.
Yes, thank you. First, I'm going to hold you to it. There's a lot of writing into it, far more than even I could actually stomach, you know. So, you know, be my guest, you know. I think you read like one fifth or even a tenth of it, I think you'll be fine, you know. But as all good books, I feel like there's got to be a good idea, good content, and, you know, nice object. But most importantly, for me as an architect, a lot of good pictures, and I feel like the book does that, you know, if I want to kind of introduce it superficially, let's say. So Mute Icons it's really an idea book. It really puts forward our view and our notion of what public, civic-minded architecture should be, should do, should consider in this particular kind of convoluted, critical time that we are in. And what I mean, the time that we're in, it's the time that maybe we've been in the last 20 years, you know, with like different crises followed by different moments of optimism and challenges to the field and to the discipline. So Mute Icons, it's at the core a book about images. It's about images in architecture, and it's about how to conceive, interrogate, analyze, look, perceive, and maybe reposition images in architecture. The images are historical, vis-a-vis precedents, you know, all back to ancient history, and are contemporary, related to our own work, of course. And what we try to do is somehow argue that contrary to, you know, the kind of shock and awe of sort of technology and only optimism about the future, which we obviously have and share, and it's part of our core of what we do, the kind of progressive architecture, the sort of forward-looking ideas, the speculation. Architecture has to kind of find, you know, sort of more mitigated, maybe more intrusive and maybe withdrawn ways of positioning things, you know, object, buildings, images that are a bit more paradoxical, you know. So Mute Icons is really about like positioning a kind of paradoxical understanding of what public architecture is and can be and is the potential to be, and argues that, you know, far from being a crowd pleaser of, like, you know, producing things that are just instant poster childs, Instagrammable picture, architecture can still maintain a certain, not autonomy, but a certain kind of position as a cultural irritant, you know. And this is something that we're really interested in, and we seek to argue from a kind of contemporary and also from a historical approach, you know, sort of trying to, in a world-making kind of way, rewrite a little bit of a history of mute iconicity, meaning like put a bunch of projects, a lot historical, some more contemporary, and including our work, that we think are doing some of these things, to basically produce an architecture that is not just for entertainment, that it has a kind of value beyond the first time that you see, the few times that you actually can maybe get to enjoy it, you know. And there's plenty of examples going that direction, and we try to do work in that direction. And so it's a bit of a kind of pushback, but not in a reactionary way. I feel like it's also in a way that is, say, push it forward, you know, let's get on with, you know, a lot of good things about technology, a lot of good things about, like, the future. And but understanding that architecture is a particular animal, you know, architecture is not fashion, it's not art, it is something else, and it's deeply enmeshed in culture, and we have something to say about it, you know. And so by writing, by talking about all these things, we're saying that.
And you mentioned about architecture is not fashion, and architecture is not just only about the probably aesthetics, and but when we look at your works, you also emphasize a lot on the form, mass, and the geometries that you know, somehow form the buildings, and they create the architecture. What type of methodologies you follow when you in your architecture or in your design philosophies at Patterns?
Yes, I mean, I think you're totally right. It might seem as an oxymoron for me to say that, you know, architecture is not fashion, it's not art, and then this is a book about images, and you associate images with the whole Instagram culture, the TikTok, all of that. So it's paradoxical, but it's also true, which is we're trying to go really, really deep into these things, and also not deny that in our own work, you know, we do a whole lot more than images. Images, if anything, is just the end of a process, let's say. And, you know, we work with drawings, we work with diagrams, we work with, like, geometries, you know, we draw and plan, and we still sketch. We do all of the above to get to those processes. And yes, our work is really based on form slash mass and slash articulation, and many, you know, and sort of moves in between these ideas. What are the processes? I mean, we sort of look back and always try to keep a kind of tab on what the process of each project is. You know, we're very attentive. We're not a process-driven practice, but we try to keep a tab in terms of how things are happening, and to understand maybe the consistency, and understand also the flaws of it. It really has to do with the development of maybe form in relationship with context, in relationship with environmental and social and cultural ideas. But there's a lot more to it, and you know, so no diagram can really just take stock of exactly how certain things happen, you know. So, and of course, there are plenty of influences, you know, from the way we draw, to the way we render, to our relationship with photography and in the arts, in terms of how to depict and create narratives in terms of the work we do, especially as it reaches the public, as it reaches culture, which is where we aspire to position and to be. I know I didn't really answer your question.
No, you completely you answered, and you mentioned great points, and you mentioned about context and cultural aspects with these current technological developments, how we can preserve or how we can balance these historical aspects and also contextual relations of the architecture with its surrounding, with the advancements that we have, how not to get lost in this flood of, you know, idea generations, and in this flood of, you know, finding new typologies for buildings, how to preserve that.
I think it's one, that's your question is one of the most critical questions, you know, nowadays, and one that I've been thinking, and we've been thinking as a practice for a while also reflecting on a lot of the work we do, which is a lot of the work is ground up, you know, in the US and elsewhere, including some work in the Middle East, you know, in Saudi Arabia, especially, where it's all new. But also a lot of the work, especially in Los Angeles, where everyone, including ourselves, have a kind of understanding of the culture of the new, the perpetual culture of the new. We have a lot of, you know, encountered a lot of existing buildings that we had to somehow work within, you know. And I think finding the value of whatever that context is, you know, whether it's in Argentina or it's in the US or it's in Bali where we're working, or in a Greek island, or in Saudi Arabia, context is very, very different. Culture is very different. Materials and methods and just the kind of urban textures are completely different. And finding ways of somehow somehow involving those, answering, connecting in some levels, it's incredibly important. And so, of course, when you're a foreigner, you have a different relationship with context than when, you know, when you're a local. And so if you're hired to do a building, you can mimic just context because A, you probably do it wrong. You don't have an understanding of it. B, that's not the kind of mission for which you were even asked to participate. So I don't know. I'm always keen in understanding a kind of deeper means of context. You know, it's kind of like you look at it, you go visit, you do research, you understand things, and then somehow you just go with it. And hopefully you find ways of those ideas getting inside your work in more substantial, essential, but also maybe deeper ways, you know. And of course, you know, I mean, the idea is that you will produce something that is both kind of familiar and strange. It's not like, it's not one or the other directly, but it is a challenge, you know, cultural.
And if we talk about the advancements in tech, that they are having a huge impact into our profession, how do you envision the future of our practice? If you want to mention a couple of points, or if you want to draw outlines or borders, or how do you envision the future?
This is always a tricky question for me. I'm not a
theorist, or
no, I'm certainly not a theorist. I'm a practicing architect, yes. And I'm an educator, of course.
That's why you can envision it easily.
Yes, probably. And I have a stake on it, but I also have a.
And I'm also get. I'm gonna get back to the education as well.
No, for sure. I do have. I'm not in the business of predicting the future, and there's a lot of my colleagues that will do that, and I sometimes they do well. I've just, you know, and the reason I am not interested in that is because I've seen enough of waves, you know, since I was, you know, educated in, you know, in New York, in Colombia, in the heyday of digital design when really just started, and I've seen enough people predict like, oh, you know, books are not going to, you know, libraries are not going to exist anymore, everything is going to be digital, and 20 years later, we're still building libraries, and they're amazing, you know, they're amazing technological places that they're not used to do what they did now, but they're still books, you know. And so you know, and I've seen a lot of people that they're just, this is going to be the end of this as we know it, and maybe some things change, but things don't change that much as we anticipated. So I'm kind of a sort of wait and see in some cases. Of course, you know, I'm excited about like some of these advances, and we use them, but we also learn to use them in ways that are not like, you know, we don't just get on the next wave and too far, because I feel like that's maybe the role of like younger generations. I think every generation has a kind of role to play, and we have already a role to play, and so we're trying to refine, we're trying to maintain a critical aspect given a certain work we do and a certain arena, you know. And so I feel it's okay that, you know, we don't have to be involved in every kind of measure, you know.
Studying architecture even before 2000, and you've seen even in Columbia University, back then the hype about digitization, the use of parametrics, yeah, and all these scripting to in architecture. In the last 25 years, how does it change the way the things that we were thinking about? All these tools will change the architecture, and how do you think these tools have changed the way we did architecture in the last 25 years? Because you were you were practicing probably before even most of these tools came to architecture, or we started using them, and now we have tools that are somehow a part of the process that we practice, actually the part of the process that we think, yes, and provide solutions. Maybe you can give us a little bit of insight. What was the discussions back then, and what are we doing now? Are we so far by the dreamland that was somehow being drawn back then, or how was it?
I mean, I was lucky to be in a moment of education in Colombia where there was still, you know, there was an excitement about what these tools will do. I mean, like, you know, whatever, Alias at the time, you know, that became Maya. This was, by the way, $20,000 computer and software that costed the same, that only two people I knew in the entire school had it, you know, and they were working, you know, one for Greg Ling and the other one for Jesse and Nanako, and it was, you know, friend of mine actually, and you know, it was just it's a different thing, and meaning that was the only time where I think, you know, people were really, really ahead of the curve, you know, and you graduated and you know what to do with all these things, you know. If you didn't start your own office, you have very, very few places where you could actually, you know, work. I started doing my own things, and there were like, and in Argentina also, four places, and then back and forth, and then back to LA. I mean, it entailed a lot of, you know, process of understanding how you would even put into mechanisms. You know, this was like obviously, you know, projects like Yokohama Port Terminal by FOA at the time was sort of being built, and at the same time, in parallel, you know, Frank was building the Guggenheim Museum, which sort of change the world. So I don't know. For me, I think those things are interesting in terms of how even like you consider the impact of technology, the relation between academia and culture, the relation of technology and how it changes, you know, where like I think after a whole wave of digital, and those two projects being paradigmatic of like two very different approaches, but sort of related, there's also a kind of backlash and other things come up, you know, a kind of another forms of regionalism, which add something to it. You know, I think add ideas of materiality, texture and color, a reminder that architecture is not just about continuity and ground and wave making or pattern making. It's about something much deeper, and that you will need that, you know. And so I don't know. I mean, it's such a complicated history and how it evolved that I think it's hard to just say one thing or the other. But I don't know. I mean, I'm just having like, you know, different kind of flashbacks in terms of, you know, in terms of how that worked. All I will say is that again, and we've done our fair share of test things, you know, excitement where like, absolutely, you know, we will do competitions and you'll try to use the latest thing, you know, being at SIARC, of course, and my partner teaches at UCLA, but especially SIARC give me a kind of it's like a first row view of many of these things, you know. I mean, through my students, through the work we do there, through, you know, studios that I taught at Cotot, through some of my younger colleagues that keep bringing new ideas and new tools and new approaches to things. So, but that, you know, somehow, and this is where kind of education and practice are different, you know, like when it comes to our office, when it comes to our own work, we try to be very, very selective about how we approach it. And I feel people should do the same, you know, in their own offices, because I think it's a very different thing, you know, to, you know, how to approach a problem through education and also how to actually relate to practice, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've been teaching in many universities, Yale, Harvard, and SciArc for sure. And how do you see the landscape of architectural education with all these technological advancements, mentioning AI with these recent advancements?
I mean, SciArc has always been at the forefront of technology in architecture since, I don't know, the late 2000s for sure, and until now. And we're obviously in a maybe what we would consider kind of post-digital moment, where, like, of course, the digital is there, but there's all sort of, you know, I think most of the most interesting people, they find ways of like hybridizing it a little bit. You know, it's not just entirely one thing. They sort of mix it up. So, I mean, I think I feel like when I talk we, SciArc specifically, are sort of committed to do that, to doing that. Of course, there's many different approaches, you know, even within the school. There is a pretty large school, and there's like, you know, battles or conversations about like the meaning of this, how far you have to go in that direction, the matter of the discipline in relationship with that, the matter of history and precedent, you know, AI, which is something that, of course, it's been in the, you know, now it's like all over, but, you know, it's been in the window of, you know, architecture for a while, and what it can do and what the possibilities are. And of course, you know, some people will say, yeah, this is going to, I mean, it's already changing the world, but it's going to change the practice as we know it. A lot of people will not have a work, you know, will not have a job that's going to replace the designer. And I certainly think it's a little bit like too naive to think that way, but it's obviously means that everyone is going to have to catch up and create kind of more authentic or more subtle ways of, you know, identifying their work. And of course, you know, AI will do what it does. And
for sure. So talking about the recent discussions in architecture, one of them definitely is the reusability and adaptability of the buildings, and the way that our industry is, construction industry is contributing to climate change is also a considerable amount that we have to think about. What do you think is, what are your thoughts on the creating architecture or the way that we can use the buildings even after their functions are somehow not in their place, or we can change their functions, we can adapt them to different type of buildings and reuse them instead of demolishing and building in a new type of building? What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I'm all for, I mean, you know, like supposedly the most sustainable thing you can do with a building is try to preserve it, you know, as opposed to like, you know, demolish it and build brand new. Sometimes it's not possible, given like really large processes and urbanization and. But I think when possible, I mean, we certainly approach it that way. We find it interesting, and in fact, you know, many of our work in Los Angeles have some aspect of, you know, of so-called adaptive reuse. Let's say, you know, there is an existing building that will, you know, will get and will do a lot to it, but there's something there. There's like a sandbox that you have to play with, and I think that, you know, all the aspects associated with the kind of, you know, environmental crisis and produce, you know, and being a little bit more sustainable with the construction industry are super crucial. It's a really huge, slow and not a really, really high profit industry to change it, you know, so much. And so it's always kind of complicated. And I also feel like even the audience that, that consume, you know, clients and so on, they want to say this is sustainable. They want to check the boxes, but there's still a bit of a cynicism about it. You know, they want to do certain things, or they want the pride that comes with, you know, saying you did that, but then they don't want to be able to, they don't want to take some of the discomfort that might be associated with that. You know, I mean, the excessive use of, you know, air conditioning is one of the aspects, let's say, that you see in maybe in the US, although there's a lot of conscience about these things, you know. I think, you know, materials and recycling and life cycle of things. I mean, these are things that I would lie to you if I say that these are front and center of what we do. I think they're obviously part of the sphere. You know, we're always trying to find, as a practice and also as educators, meaningful ways of incorporating these problems without just making them, much like often society and culture does, like, you know, themes, like, you know, or suddenly sustainability became important, and then you have the sustainability awards, you know, and it's like, who gives, a damn about that if it's not good architecture, you know? If it's good architecture, and it's great, you know? I mean, it should be sustainable, you know? But if it's not good, I mean, I don't think you should win an award, you know? And so, you know, so these are things that we try to be positive and optimistic, but also be a little bit critical sometimes about what this sort of like name tagging and this kind of classification that I mean, in the US, we see a lot, you know? And I think that maybe that's a kind of our both sort of like educators, architects idea that we try to be, you know, to question what does it mean? You know, what does it mean? What do you do? How do you do it? So as that you're not just relinquishing the real power of architecture to do what it does best and do so in a kind of more propositional way, you know?
And you have been an architect who's been practicing and also an academia who's teaching in school and having, you know, books and articles, writing and educating students. How does this feed into your, how does academia feed in your architecture, and how does practicing an architect lets you to educate the next generations? How does this balance, how do you use this as to keep your architecture forward?
Ever since I finished school in Argentina, I wanted to, you know, of course, I wanted to be an architect. But for me, being an architect also was being an educator. Being teaching was something I wanted to do. I felt like I had things to explore. You know, I don't want to say give back. You know, it sounds a little too humble and maybe a little bit more selfish than that. And I think a lot of people are. And I think with the selfishness comes the interest where, like, I mean, I'm part of a culture and a school at SAIARC, which was founded under the premise of creating a place, an environment sort of halfway between the architect's studio and conventional academia. Of course, we're much more academic than what we used to be, but still as a sort of lively side to it that I think it's important to me. It's important to our office, you know, a lot of, you know, I mean, my partner, you know, is a professor at UCLA. But I think our office has got a lot, you know, it's got a lot from SAIARC, you know, it's got a lot of like former students that work for us. And so I often said, you know, we couldn't do the work we do if we were not related to academia. Having said that, we also try to make sure that you know, that we are outside academia, because when it comes to like participating in real world, people are not going to hire you because you're an academic. You know, they, you know, you need to be a professional, you know? And so, but the idea that you're kind of part of the education process, you have, you know, you work with like incredibly talented young minds, that you bring problems to it and then together, you know, figure out like tentative solutions, tentative responses to those ideas. And that's super important. But one thing for me is important, and that's that I always like, I could not, you know, I couldn't practice if I wasn't teaching the way I do. I couldn't teach if I wasn't practicing the way I do. Like, I think every time I situate a new problem, a new idea, that's my approach. It has something to do with some of the problems, things, projects, ideas that I encounter in the real world. And then, of course, when it goes to my studios, when it goes to a design topic, it has, you know, it has a far more forward-looking idea, you know. And the same way, you know, we're obviously keen in incorporating some of the discussions that I think are selectively important and then often come to, you know, our own studios and our own discussions and reviews and so on.
Right. And if you would like to share, like if you haven't signed any NDAs or something, are you working with any projects in Saudi Arabia?
I did sign NDS, you know, so I can say too much, you know. I mean, but we're, you know, working on some exciting projects and some new to come, and so I mean, all I can say is that I am very supportive and excited about what the whole process of I don't know, urbanization is not the right word, because there's already urban places, there's just like new ideas, and I think it's a very, very interesting and fertile environment to you know.
So what do you think about projects like the line and proposals that have been coming from some kind of leading architecture practices in the world? Yes. So Tamein and Morphosis and also somehow it reminds me of one of the projects that Liam Young had to incorporate the whole world's population in one city.
Yes.
So what are your thoughts on projects like this that are so much looking utopia, or in some cases people say dystopian as well? Maybe you can share some points.
I mean, we have some involvement with that project. Not a huge involvement. I mean, I'm excited about the project. I think I am excited about the premise of the idea of like a kind of radical conservation of a territory and densification. It's funny being in this trip. I was, you know, I've been to Dubai before and I've been to Abu Dhabi, but this time I was in Dubai, and I tried to walk and see new things. And I was obviously in Riyadh, and I was in Jeddah, and I was also in Beirut. And Beirut was maybe a bit of a different, you know, exception, because you can walk your streets. But I mean, in Dubai, it will take me like 40 minutes to cross, you know, if I wanted to walk. You know, I had to take Ubers just to go around, and because there were not like bridges, there were not like, they're not cities made for pedestrians. And a lot of things are happening in Riyadh and even in Jeddah, and although Jeddah maybe has better swatches of pedestrian aspects. So I feel like the premise of creating a place, you know, like the line, that it was going to be, you know, we're not going to have cars there. You're just going to move and you're going to walk, you know, horizontally or move vertically. It is the right premise. Does it have to be, you know, that condensed? Does it have to be so high? Those are maybe things that I think a lot of people will have issues. And I certainly, you know, I will certainly think that there may be obviously other possibilities, but I'm excited and I'm supportive of the endeavor. And as I think you know, if it's like, you know, if not now, when, you know, if there is a possibility, if, like, I think it's great that you have those kinds of approaches. And sure, I mean, like everything else, you'll have, like, you know, remains to be seen how much, you know, I mean, there were like this master city in Abu Dhabi by Foster, which, you know, in paper was one thing, and the reality, I mean, it's actually quite a nice place. I actually been there, I visited, but still far from over, far from completed, far from realized, no?
Yes, I mean, the whole idea about this question was not just to criticize, because we, as media platform, we see no position for ourselves to criticize any project. We just uncover the truth and
yeah.
just share the news about the recent developments. I'm a huge fan of the project, and we support the we published the line and developments by NEOM and our platform a lot, because we see a new vision and a new horizon.
Absolutely, yes.
For architecture in this region. And yeah, we're just a supportive media platform that shares the news. Well, thank you so much. I have a few last questions. Is there any inspiring architect that you admire their work, living or non-living?
Yeah, many, many architects. I am, for one, you know, like, you know, I'm Argentinian, and so I always, like, you know, read a lot of Borges. You know, Jorge Luis Borges was a kind of a, you know, really a famous writer. And he used to say something that he was proud of all the, I mean, he was a genius and read some of the most amazing books. And he said, but he would say, like, kind of humbly and arrogant at the same time, you know, that he was proud about all the books he had read, you know, more than the books he had written. Of course, he could not have written what he wrote, you know, should not have read what he read. You know, same time, like, somebody like Quentin Tarantino will also kind of talked about and quote so many movies, and his work is kind of, you know, amazing. So I always look at many different people, including people that are maybe less known, and I, you know, and I'm kind of amazed by finding things in places that I didn't, you know, that I didn't expect. Of course, I mean, like, people like Corbusier were still, like, really important to me in my early education, and as it is still today, or I don't know, somebody like Clorindo Testa in Argentina was, you know, pretty significant. So it's people like, I don't know, somebody like Alvaro Siza, who that's not exact, you know, that's very different than what we do, but it was very, very significant, and their work in terms of how to, you know, create something which is kind of unique and a little bit like off the beaten path. But there's many people, of course, you know.
Well, awesome. And in closing, maybe can you share a couple of advices with young generation and aspiring architects and young talents in this ever evolving world of architecture, technology and the tools, advancements, how not to get lost? And maybe your advices can be a candle and a lighthouse in this vastness of ocean.
No, I mean, I just think, like, you know, I remember when I was still in Argentina, and Peter Eisman came for a biennial. It was the first time that he came, and it was like during the kind of whole, you know, right after deconstruction, and it was a big deal, and of course he was presented with a bunch of, like, young people in Argentina trying to do his work, and he said something which is, you know, still sticks with me, you know, which is like, you know, be yourself, you know, find your own way. And I would add, like, you know, don't be scared of taking risks, you know. In fact, take risks, because those risks are going to maybe differentiate, you know, you from the large crowd, the mainstream, the people that are just kind of followers. Because every time had certain things that are important, you know, call it the digital, whatever, scripting, tectonic, material, AI, all of those things, that's just things, you know. They're, I wouldn't say they're just the means to an end, because they're more than that, but you have to do your own work, you know, whether you're a writer, you're a historian, you're a critic, you're an architect, you know, you're an artist. And that means that at some point, you know, it's kind of like a, I don't know if you have a dog, I have a dog, you know, when, like, they put these cones to the dogs, you know, so they can, like, lick themselves. You have to kind of, you know, you have to be aware of what's going on in the world, But at some point, you have to have a super, super narrow focus and concentrate on that focus and kind of solve your true, and then your time will come, you know. And if anything, you'll have a, you know, more success in defining a territory for you and for everyone else.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you so much, Marcelo. And it's really nice to have you in here. It was a nice conversation. Appreciate your time.
No, thank you. It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.